then nodded in the direction of the prosecutor's desk. What followed was a lengthy discussion about the appropriate bond for my drug charges. In the end, Mr. Honeywell got the Commonwealth to agree to $40,000. I'd get credit for the $20,000 that had already been secured, but someone would still have to come up with 10% of the other $20,000. I knew Teddy didn't have that much. Neither did Ben, assuming he hadn't already fled north, taking me up on my get-out-of-marriage-free card. After that was settled, the judge announced the end of General District Court's broadcast day. As soon as he stood up, the camera at the courthouse began panning to the right, taking the judge out of the frame. I kept watching the screen as the view became the clerk's desk, then the wall, then the prosecutor's desk. By the time the camera came to a rest, it was pointed back at the gallery, which was empty for all but one man. It was Marcus Peterson. I felt this immediate and strong rush of gratitude toward him and this unexpected kindness. Just a glimpse of him was like spying a rose bush growing in a weedy, vacant lot. "Marcus!" I called out. "Thank you! Thank you for coming! You're the best!" Marcus gave no indication he had heard me. It was possible the feed going to the courthouse had already been cut off.
"All right, Barrett, come on," a guard said. "Let's go."
"But it's Marcus," I said, as if the man cared.
"Uh-huh," he said. "Let's go."
By then, the screen was already blank. I was still warmed at the memory of seeing my friend 2 hours later when that same guard approached me in the dormitory.
"Come on, Barrick," he said. "Get your stuff."
"I made bail?" I asked. He nodded. Marcus. It had to be. Marcus never flaunted it, but there was a modest amount of money running through his family, enough that he wasn't scraping along like the rest of us. I hurriedly collected my bras and underwear, rolling them into a ball, then signed for my jeans and sweatshirt. After changing quickly and trying to make my hair look presentable, I went out into the waiting room. And sure enough, there he was. When we first met 5 years earlier, I was 26 and Marcus was 34, which made me think of him as being maybe half a generation older. But once we became friends, I had never felt like we were different ages. Whether I was a little bit of an old soul or he was young at heart, we just clicked. I don't think we've ever had a bad conversation or an awkward moment. Once Ben came into the picture, he swore Marcus's generosity toward me was motivated by feelings for me that were considerably stronger than friendship. Ben pointed out that Marcus always seemed to be magically available any time I expressed a desire to hang out. I swore, with equal conviction, that was nonsense. Marcus put me on a little bit of a pedestal, yes, but he was just a sweetheart of a guy and nothing more. And here he was, proving it again.
"Hey, you," Marcus said softly.
Marcus was medium height and build, with dirty blonde hair and blue eyes. He was now 39, but had a boyishness about him that made him look a decade younger.
"I can't tell you how good it is to see you," I said, crossing the room toward him.
We hugged. He was a good hugger, the kind who didn't hold back. Ben always took our hugs as yet another sign of Marcus's feelings toward me. But I think I had finally convinced my husband how ridiculous that was. Marcus had never indicated the slightest unhappiness about his marriage, and unlike Warren Plotts, Marcus had never hit on me, not even when we went out drinking together. He was so asexual toward me that when I first met him, I wondered if he was gay. I mean, sure, he wore a wedding ring, but that's no longer a sure sign of heterosexuality. And when he referred to Kelly, I knew that could sometimes be a man's name. It wasn't until I met Kelly that I stopped wondering.
I have been so worried about you, he said, still hugging me.
Thanks, I said. I let go. He clung for an extra moment or two, then released me. I took in a deep breath and let it go sharply.
Marcus, this is really amazing of you, but I don't know when I'll be able to repay you.
You don't have to. I didn't work with a bail bondsman. I posted the whole 20,000, so I get it back as soon as you show up in court.
Oh my God, Marcus, that's amazing.
It's no big deal, he said, shaking his head slightly, like he had done nothing more consequential than lending me a pen. You've just got to do me one favor. You can't breathe a word about this to Kelly, okay?
Okay. I didn't want to make an issue out of it, not after he had so gallantly saved me from 6 weeks of bad sleep and worse food. But he had never asked me to keep anything from his wife before. They were the kind of couple who shared a Facebook account and knew each other's email passwords. As far as I knew, they didn't have secrets.
It's just that I sold some stock my grandparents left me and—
Oh my God, Marcus, you can't take it easy. It's not a big deal, really.
I think the stock is about to take a dive. It's safer sitting in a bond at the courthouse than it is in the market. After this is over, I'll tell Kelly I decided to sell. It'll be fine. This is really just a brief, no-interest loan.
Okay, I said warily. It was selfish of me, but I had bigger things to worry about than a white lie to Marcus's wife. Then I added, thank you.
Let's go, he said.
We left the building, walking out into a fog-socked day that felt metaphorically appropriate for someone whose future was as hazy as mine. Sensing I needed some small talk, Marcus yammered at me during the short drive back to Desper Hollow Road. When we arrived, Ben's car wasn't in the driveway. Was he at the mattress store? Or was he already in Philadelphia? Marcus came to a stop.
You want to get takeout or something? He asked. Kelly's working late tonight, so I don't really need to be anywhere.
Thanks, but no, I've got... I eyed the place where Ben usually parked his car. Some stuff to take care of.
Okay, he said.
I grabbed my grubby little ball of underwear from where I had left it on the floor and looked him in the eye. Thanks again for doing this.
Don't mention it, he said, then cracked a little bit of a grin. Like, seriously, don't mention it.
Okay, okay, got it, I said. We hugged one last time, then I got out, giving him a little wave before I hurried up the steps and to my front door. Once inside, it didn't take more than 3 seconds before I knew something was off. This wasn't like a few days earlier when the entire place had been tossed. It was much more subtle. There was a small extra amount of negative space in my house. Something was missing, even if I couldn't tell immediately what was gone. The furniture was where it should have been. The TV was in the same spot. The entertainment center was... That was it. The entertainment center. There was a hole in the place where Ben's vinyl records should have been. Chapter 25. For a moment, or two, or three, I didn't move. Our entertainment center was made of black laminate over particle board, an IKEA special that was already beginning to sag under the weight of time. Those records were ordinarily a nice distraction from the shoddiness of the piece, a splash of polychromatic cheer, all those spines creating a bright mosaic of vertical lines. Now it was just a black hole, like someone had punched out a tooth.
I quickly inventoried the rest of the house. In the kitchen, the first thing I noticed was that the Vitamix was gone. The super-strength juicer had been our Christmas present to each other, part of our promise to eat healthier now that we had a baby. Even though we went for one that had been reconditioned and was therefore cheaper than a new one, it was still expensive.
Really?
I thought indignantly. You're going to leave me and take one of the only nice things we own? I went upstairs next. Sure enough, his half of our closet was emptier than it used to be. Though, strangely, his nicer clothes, his professor duds, were still there. Only his casual clothing was absent. His dresser was also a curiosity. Most of the socks and underwear were gone. So were his older jeans, the ones that I always joked came from his hip-hop phase, along with most of his t-shirts. Only the ones he wore while mowing the lawn or painting remained. It was like he had packed for a long trip, but it was a trip whose destination made no sense. If he was running off to join Professor Kramer at Temple, why didn't he take his blazers, his slacks? Had he fled or not? Oddly, the thing that made me think he might still be around was that he hadn't bothered to leave a note. Surely he would have done that. Some last words for the woman he had shared 5 mostly good years with. If only to be polite. But he hadn't written me, because he wasn't really gone. Not knowing I had been bailed out, he had probably spent time before his shift at the mattress store going around to consignment shops and selling everything we had of value, the records, the Vitamix, in an attempt to get me out of jail. That's why he hadn't taken his professor clothes. The hip-hop jeans must have had extra value as collector's items that a white girl like me wasn't aware of. Ben was right now at work, desperately trying to wrap up 1 or 2 more sales, counting his pennies on his way to the bail amount he needed to raise. Or he had sold everything for gas money and taken off. Either way, I had to know. The store was only a few minutes away. Before long, I was pulling into the narrow parking lot that fronted the strip mall containing Mattress Marketplace. I walked through the glass doors into a large showroom, then approached a skinny young man, a few years younger than me, sitting alone at a desk. He stood when he saw me.
"Welcome to Mattress Marketplace," he said. "Do you want to just have a look around, or can I..."
"Hi, I'm actually looking for Ben Barrick."
"He's not here right now, but I'd be happy to help you. Are you hoping for something on the firm side, or..."
"I'm not a customer," I said. "I'm his wife." The kid did a poor job hiding his surprise. He wasn't expecting a white woman.
He hummed.
"Is he in back?" I asked, walking in that direction, like I knew where I was going.
He's not here," he said.
"Is he on break or something?" The kid was just staring at me. His Adam's apple bobbed up and down.
Didn't he tell you?"
"Tell me what?"
"Ben quit on Saturday morning. He just came in, said he was done, and took off."
I forget how I replied, or if I said anything at all. I just know my exit from the store was probably less than graceful. The 100-foot wave of emotions crashing on top of me, embarrassment, shame, fury, made it difficult to remember more basic functions, like walking and breathing. I tottered out to my car, barely able to get the keys in the ignition. I just had to get out of that parking lot, away from that skinny kid and his perplexed stare. Ben really was gone. For as much as I tried to trick myself into believing I was a confident woman who had managed to survive her rotten childhood, there was always lurking somewhere inside me. a little girl who had been abandoned by the two people who were supposed to love her most. That little girl had always expected this day to come. That little girl knew there was nothing permanent about love or the people who claimed to have it for her. It lasted only as long as it was convenient for them. It had been true for my parents and for all the foster parents who had come and gone. And now it was true for Ben, too. My soon-to-be ex-husband hadn't even bothered sleeping on the decision to leave me, nor had he taken more than perhaps an hour to come to it. He left the jail at, what, 10 o'clock on Saturday morning? 10:30? He then either went straight to the mattress place and quit, or he had made it his last stop on the way out of town after hastily collecting his stuff. It's a wonder I hadn't seen tire marks as he laid rubber to get out of the driveway. Except, of course, this wasn't some kind of rushed choice. He had probably been looking for an escape hatch since the sheriff's raid. Or maybe longer. Like from when he first saw the pale-skinned baby he had obviously not fathered. The moment I offered him a way out, he hadn't just walked through it. He had sprinted. I had to put him out of my mind. Mourning his departure or letting it incapacitate me wouldn't do me any good. Shocking as it was, Ben was now a person in my past, another wound that would slowly heal over. I was returning to my natural state, on my own, with no one else I could depend on. But I wasn't alone, for whatever the Commonwealth of Virginia might soon have to say about it, there was Alex. I was still his mother. Alex needed me to stay strong for him, to spare him from the same kind of childhood I had, from the system. I wasn't going to abandon him the way my parents abandoned me. April 9th was coming. Forget Ben. Forget Warren Plotts and Diamond Trucking. Alex, and the trial that would allow me to win him back, had to be my focus. I wondered if Teddy had been able to make any headway over the weekend on that picture I had sent him. He would just be coming home from work. I called him. No answer. The turn for Desper Hollow was coming up, but I already knew I wasn't taking it. I was going to Teddy's place. Maybe together we could figure out who that scar-headed man from the video really was. Teddy's rental was a large, gruesomely asymmetrical Victorian on the wrong side of town that loomed over the street below it, looking like the crazy man's house in a B-grade horror flick. I parked on the street and climbed the concrete steps next to the sidewalk, then the wooden steps that led to the porch. Teddy always told me I could just walk right in, that the other guys knew I was his sister and wouldn't care, but I always felt weird doing that. So I rang the bell. After a short wait, one of his roommates, the one who worked at the sheriff's office, came to the door, looking a lot less official in jeans and bare feet than he did in his deputy's uniform.
"Hey,"
he said, opening the door wide so I could come in. "Hey, thanks," I said, giving him a quick smile before I went up the stairs toward Teddy's room on the third floor. But he stopped me before I could get that far.
"If you're looking for Teddy, he's not here," he said. "You just missed him."
"Oh," I said. "Did he tell you where he was going by any chance?"
"No, he was with that chick."
"What chick?" I asked. My 23-year-old brother clearly didn't need to clear his dating life with me, but I wasn't aware he had a new girlfriend.
"You know, the one he used to date."
I immediately felt sick.
"Wendy?"
I said, the name bringing a curl to my lips.
"I think that's her name, yeah. Dark hair, about yay high," he said, holding up his hand to roughly my height. "Hot as hell, but also a hot mess."
"Yeah,"
That's her. She's been staying here the last few days, he said. They left here maybe 15-20 minutes ago.
He must have seen my shoulders drop, because he added,
It's none of my business, but she's bad news, isn't she?
The worst.
Well, whatever. Like I said, none of my business, he said. If he comes back, you want me to tell him you were here?
No, I said firmly. Don't bother. I retreated back down the steps and sat in my car. I flashed back to the conversation we had in the parking lot, when he had bailed me out, when I thought I, his all-knowing older sister, could stare the truth out of him.
Are you seeing Wendy again? I had asked.
No, he insisted. And I actually believed him. Now I found myself asking the question I least wanted to consider. What else had he lied about?
Chapter 26. The hand was on her hip, pressing just a little bit. In those moments of incoherence between sleep and wakefulness, Amy Kay wasn't sure if this was part of a dream or whether her husband really was sitting on the edge of the bed.
Aim? Aim? He said.
She stared at him with incomprehension. Then it finally clicked in. Yes, her husband was there. He was no longer dressed in chef's clothing, but he still smelled like onions. Could you smell in dreams? No. So she must have been awake.
Your phone was ringing, and I saw it was Jason Powers, so I answered it, he said softly.
He had been covering the mouthpiece with his finger, but was now holding the phone out for her. Amy grabbed it, sitting up, now at least semi-functioning. The clock by her bed read 2:58. Had she been a little more awake, she would have already known what this was about.
Hey, it's Amy.
Yeah, hey. Sorry to wake you, he said.
The sheriff's voice sounded funereal, bearing none of its usual cordiality.
No problem. What's going on?
We got a sexual assault on our hands. I think it's your guy.
Amy swore, then blindly pounded the pillow next to her.
I was out driving around when the call came in, he said. We haven't gotten the full story yet, but the victim told us the attacker was a guy wearing a mask who whispered the whole time. We're about to take her to the hospital to get checked out, but I wanted to give you a chance to talk to her first.
Where are you?
Powers recited an address in Mount Solon. It was in the northern reaches of Augusta County, at least a 30-minute drive from Stanton. Amy didn't want to wait that long for the rape kit to be administered. Speed mattered.
You think there's physical evidence? She asked.
She didn't need to get graphic with Powers about what she meant.
Might be.
Then let's get her to the hospital. You taking her to Augusta Health?
That was the plan.
All right. Why don't you send her on down, then? I'll talk to her after the kit is done.
You got it, he said.
Then he added,
I think you're really going to like talking to this one.
What do you mean? Amy asked.
You'll see when you meet her, he said,
then ended the call. Augusta Health, the regional hospital, was only 15 minutes away from where Amy lived. It had staff members who had been trained as sexual assault forensic examiners. Amy could visit the scene in Mount Solon later in the day on Tuesday if she needed to. Right now, harvesting evidence mattered more. As she pulled on a pantsuit, then hurriedly ran a brush through her hair, Amy felt physically ill. This was what she had dreaded all weekend, really from the moment she got Warren Plotz to kiss that Sprite can. Plotz was so clearly due. Overdue, actually. Sitting across from him, she had been able to feel the evil in him filling to the bursting point. She was already second-guessing everything about the past few days of her life. Had she really pressed on the lab director, Chap Burleson, as hard as she could have? She should have camped out at the lab and refused to leave until he gave her a result. For that matter, she could have had Plotz arrested. Yeah, so she didn't have rock-solid probable cause. Once she got a DNA match, no sane judge, and certainly no judge in conservative-leaning Augusta County, Virginia, would have gotten overly picky with her. There was so much she could have done, should have done. She already knew it was one of those mistakes that would embed itself in her brain forever. It would sit there and slowly snack on her conscience, regurgitating its memory any time Amy felt like berating herself for past failures. As she rushed toward the door, she made a promise to this victim, to future victims, and to herself. She wouldn't rest until Warren Plotz was in custody, locked away in a place where he could never hurt another woman. Her last words to her husband were, "Don't wait up for me." Lily Pritchett. That was the name of the young woman Amy would never forget. She was 21, a student at nearby Bridgewater College. She had been living in a small rented cottage out in the country. It sat on the property of an elderly couple, who naturally hadn't heard or seen anything from the main house. The rest of the property was in such a rural area, there were unlikely to be any other witnesses. That was the total of what Amy learned from a deputy while they waited for Lily's rape kit to be administered. No one had gotten the full story of the attack yet. At the scene, Sheriff Powers had decided he wanted to make the victim go through the incident only once, and Amy was the right person to hear it. Powers was still up in Mount Solon, collecting evidence, as Amy and the deputy waited outside the victim's hospital room. The smells of the hallway were so sterile, so antiseptic, so at odds with the vileness of the attack. By the time the nurses had finished, it was after 6 o'clock. As the medical people cleared out, Amy went in. Lily was sitting up in bed, a sheet pulled up to her belly. She wore clean pajamas, not a hospital gown, which showed someone at Augusta Health knew what they were doing. Her yellow hair was sleep-matted, but there was something in her green eyes that encouraged Amy, a light that remained, even though it could have easily been extinguished. "Hi, Lily. I'm Amy Kay. I'm with the Commonwealth's Attorney's Office."
"Lily Pritchett."
Amy grabbed her extended hand. Her grip was still strong. "How are you?" Amy asked.
"Tired."
"I'll bet. I wanted to ask you a few questions. Would you rather I come back after you've had a chance to rest?"
"No. Let's get this over with."
"All right. Why don't you just start at the beginning?"
"Okay,"
Lily said, pulling the sheet up a little higher.
"I probably went to bed around 11 or so. I was out cold when the guy came in my room."
"Do you have any idea how he got in?"
"The front door was locked, if that's what you're asking. There's a back door that you can kind of force open if you really lean on it, but to answer the question, no, I don't know how he got in."
"Okay, go on," she said.
"The door to my room was closed, but it's an old house. It makes this noise when you open it, and I'm kind of a light sleeper. That's what woke me up. And then he started with this whisper. It was so scary."
"What was he saying?"
"He started by going, 'Shh, shh, don't scream, don't yell. I'm not here to hurt you.' And then he held up this, like, sword, and he goes, 'I'll only use this if I have to.' By then I could see that he was wearing gloves and dark clothes and this black ski mask, and I guess that's when I freaked out."
"I'll only use this if I have to," was a phrase more than a dozen victims had reported hearing. Any question about whether there was a connection between this attack and the others had now vanished.
So he was wearing a mask, Amy said. How else would you describe him? Did you get a sense of his height or weight or anything else about him?
I tried. I sort of went into this mode where I knew I was going to have to eventually be a witness about this guy. I watched a lot of Law and Order SVU reruns when I was in high school, and I actually used to think about how if Mariska Hargitay ever came to interview me, I wanted to be able to give her a lot of stuff to go on. Does that sound ridiculous?
Not at all, Amy reassured her. It's quite helpful, actually. It means you kept your head about you. You'll be really good at testifying when we catch this guy.
Lily smiled a little. You think you will?
I feel good about our chances. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. Keep going. We were just getting to height and weight.
Yeah, so I'd say about 5'10 or 5'11, pretty average. And weight, I'm not very good at guessing guys' weights. It's not like he was fat or anything. Maybe 175? Is that normal for a guy?
Amy knew Plotz was probably closer to 200, but 20 or 25 pounds certainly put it within an acceptable margin of error. Could you tell what race he was?
White.
Anything else?
Not really. I'm sorry. I mean, it was dark and
I understand. Don't worry, you're doing great, Amy said. We've gotten up to him coming into the room. What next?
Like I said, he started whispering at me and telling me not to be scared and that he wasn't going to hurt me as long as I cooperated. And he kept saying please and thank you, and he was, I mean, for a rapist, he was really polite, you know?
Amy nodded.
Anyway, I started crying because I was so scared, and he actually tried to calm me down. He was like, shh, don't cry, don't cry. He said he was sorry he was doing this to me. And I was like, if you're sorry, why are you doing it? Why don't you just stop? Don't do this. And then he said, because I have to. And then he said he was sorry again and told me to take my clothes off. I told him I wouldn't. And then he brought the sword up and said something like, it would be a shame if I had to cut that pretty face of yours.
To Amy, this was evidence a power reassurance rapist was progressing toward becoming what the profilers called a power assertive. He still wanted the illusion of romance, because that was what excited him, but he was perhaps willing to use force to get it. It made him all that much more dangerous.
What did you do? Amy asked.
I guess I knew he was going to do what he was going to do. And I mean, I've had sex with guys before when I didn't really want to, so I told myself to think of this as just one more time I was having bad sex. And that sort of helped calm me down. And then, I don't know, I really got thinking about how I was going to get raped no matter what, and I wanted to be able to catch this loser when this was all over. And I thought, well, how am I going to take a better look at this guy so I can ID him later? Because he had that mask on and all that. Anyway, I told him I felt embarrassed being the only one naked, and I would only take off my clothes if he took off his.
Wow, Amy said, impressed by her quick thinking. Did he do it?
He told me it didn't work that way. He told me I was the one who had to take off my clothes. But I was still thinking about Law and Order and what Mariska Hargitay would want me to do. And I was thinking about how she would want DNA or fingerprints. So I said, okay, and I took off my clothes and I let him, you know, get inside me. And then, you're going to think I'm a total slut, but
you are not a slut, Amy said immediately. Stop that right now. You are a survivor and a damn smart one.
Well, anyway, I started acting like I was really into it, you know? Just to get him distracted. I went full-on porn star with the whole, oh yeah, baby, yeah, that feels so good. And the whole time I was like, barf, but I was just waiting for the right moment.
For what?
To rip his gloves off, she said. He had his hands on the bed at first, so I couldn't really get a grip on them. But then he put one of his hands on my boob, and I just tore the glove off. He was like, what the? But I was still in porn star mode, so I was like, I want to feel your hand on my skin. And he was like, give me the glove. And I was acting like I was in the heat of passion, so I was all, don't stop. Come on, big boy. Harder, harder. And then I sort of knocked him into some stuff. He definitely touched my bedpost. And I had some books on my bed that I had been studying before I fell asleep. He touched those, too.
In nearly 30 previous attacks, they had never gotten fingerprints. It was a remarkable bit of cunning from a scared 21-year-old college student. You are incredibly, incredibly brave, Amy said. And you may well have given us what we need to catch this guy. I want to call the sheriff to make sure he knows about this. Would you mind if I made a quick phone call?
Go ahead.
Amy went out into the hallway and dialed Powers's number. As soon as he answered, Amy began the conversation with, "You are never going to believe this, but I think this asshole left prints." Powers answered, "Well, you're never going to believe this, but on our way out the door, your victim told us to dust like hell for prints. And I think we already got some."
Chapter 27. I slept in the middle of the bed that night. This was my effort, pitiful though it may have been, to assert control over my situation, over the husband who had left me, the brother who was back together with his drug addict girlfriend, and the people who were trying to steal my baby. My attempts at self-empowerment and self-delusion continued into the morning. My 5-day hearing wasn't scheduled until 10:30, so I pumped, then showered and donned the most court-appropriate dress I had, a long-sleeved, belted maxi dress. I found it in a thrift store, but had been told it made me look like Kate Middleton. Then I splurged and went into a coffee shop in downtown Stanton, where I sat with tea and a scone, busy with my phone, as if I were any other young woman with her act together. I did all of this because I knew where I was heading. Juvenile and domestic relations court played a featured role in a number of my childhood memories. None of them were pleasant. Mostly, I remembered the women. There was such sadness about them. It wasn't just that they had lost their pride, their self-esteem, or their looks, or that some of them had bruises or scars, or that they were overwhelmed by one aspect of the system or another. It was that, in every one of them, there was still this sense of surprise, like they didn't belong there with all the other damaged women. They understood the choices that led them to this spot. The guy they never should have married, the drugs they never should have taken, the poverty they should have been clever enough to escape. But this still wasn't who they really were. Or at least it wasn't who they were supposed to have been. I can remember being angry with my father that he had turned my mother into one of these women. And now I was sitting in a coffee shop, nibbling at a scone, pretending I wasn't one of them myself. Looking for a happier thought, I searched for some recollection of Alex that would restore some of the good mojo I was so desperately groping for. What I found, fairly quickly, was one from when Alex was about 7 weeks old. It was toward the end of my first week back at work, and we were all struggling with the transition.
Long days were being followed by long nights. The excitement of having a baby had definitely worn off. What replaced it was the reality that no one really tells you about ahead of time. New parenting was mostly just drudgery. I had picked Alex up from Mrs. Ferncliff's and given him his evening feeding. It was about time for him to drop off for a slumber that, if I was lucky, would last until at least 1 or 2 in the morning. Alex hadn't really been looking at anything, just doing that 1,000-yard newborn stare. And then suddenly his eyes locked onto mine. The color of Alex's eyes were still settling in, as happens with newborns, but they were showing signs of turning into this enchanting shade of blue-gray. They were the kind of eyes you could just get lost in. And that's what I was doing, just staring into his eyes when it happened. Like a fabulous new idea was slowly occurring to him, this huge smile spread across his face. There had been times when I thought maybe he was smiling before that, but it was already hard to tell if it was that or if he was just passing gas. This was the first time it felt totally intentional. It was one of those moments that made his grip on my heart, which I had already thought was total, just a little bit stronger. And now here I was in a coffee shop, needing to see those eyes and that smile again, almost as much as I needed to keep breathing. I made myself wait until 10:20 to enter the courthouse building, if only because I didn't want to get myself too worked up about my first appearance before the judge who would have such an enormous say over my fate. After passing through security, I made the familiar march toward juvenile and domestic relations court, which hadn't changed much since I was a teenager. It was a narrow, low-ceilinged room with 7 rows of benches that were a bit like church pews, except it had always struck me this was about as far from God as you could get. Up front, bantering with a woman who appeared to be another attorney, was Mr. Honeywell. This was my first time seeing him in person. He was older than he looked on camera, at least 65, though he was so droopy he easily could have passed for 75. His nose had the fine spider veining of a man who often found his escape in a bottle. He had ditched his wrinkled suit in favor of a blue blazer and gray slacks. His tie hugged the top of his rounded belly, then dangled off the cliff at the bottom by at least a foot. When he saw me, he actually did a double take, like he was surprised I was there. He quickly excused himself from his conversation, then came my way. He had a limp that caused him to favor his left leg, something I hadn't been able to see on camera. He was staring at me strangely, like maybe I had some food stuck on my cheek and he was debating whether to tell me. Then he mustered a weary smile.
"Miss Barrick, if I may say, you look lovely this morning," he said in a way that managed to come off as kind, not old man sleazy. I think it was the warmth of the smile and the eye contact. I realized he hadn't seen me in person before either. The other times I was on a television screen, dressed in jailhouse orange. "Thank you," I said. He looked at me for about 3 beats longer than he probably needed to, then sat next to me so we could talk in voices that couldn't be heard up front.
"The other matters scheduled for this morning have all wrapped up, so Judge Stone is just taking a break," he said.
He then ran through the people in the courtroom. Donna Fell, the attorney who would represent social services, an attractive dark-haired woman who looked to be in her mid-40s. Tina Anderson, the family services specialist, whom I had already met. The guardian ad litem, who
who would speak on Alex's behalf, the representative from court-appointed special advocates, and so on. Then Mr. Honeywell's eyes bugged out even further than usual. I followed his line of sight back to the front of the room, where Shenandoah Valley Social Services Director Nancy Dement was now entering. She wore a jacket with a loud pattern and epaulets on the shoulders. Her face seemed to have an extra caking of makeup.
"What's she doing here?"
he muttered, mostly to himself. Then, not taking his attention from the front of the room, he began,
"That's..."
Nancy Dement. "I know. Does she not normally show up at these things?"
"Not for years. Not since she went up to management," he said.
His already lined face got a deeper set to it. "Then what's she doing here?"
"No idea," he said. "But let's go to the table up front. I think we're about to get underway."
We had just gotten settled there when a sheriff's deputy strode purposefully into the courtroom and announced, "All rise!" As I stood, Judge Stone entered the room. He was a tall African-American man with just the right amount of gray in his otherwise black hair.
"Have a seat, everyone,"
he said in a deep voice that could have easily anchored the bass section in a church choir.
"This is the preliminary removal hearing for DSS versus Barrick. Mr. Honeywell, I assume this is Ms. Barrick?"
"Yes, Your Honor."
"Is everyone else here that we need?"
Heads around the room bobbed.
"Okay, then let's get started. Ms. Fell, why don't you go ahead?"
"Thank you, Your Honor," Donna Fell said. "I'd like to start by calling Tina Anderson, Family Services Specialist from Shenandoah Valley Social Services."
Over the next 20 minutes, Fell led Anderson through her testimony. Some of it was perfunctory: how long she had worked at social services, what her qualifications were, that sort of thing. Then they moved on to the meat of the matter. She described how the sheriff's office notified social services it was executing a warrant on my house, how there was believed to be a child at the residence, and how she was on the premises when the raid occurred.
"You were standing outside on the lawn, is that right?"
Fell asked.
"Yes, ma'am." "And what did you then observe?"
"The deputies started coming out with drug paraphernalia that they said was consistent with a large distribution ring. They showed me a box with scales, baggies for packaging drugs, a list of phone numbers of what they said were known drug users in the area, and Ms. Barrick's mobile phone."
"Ms. Barrick's mobile phone? Was that why I hadn't been able to find the thing? But how had it possibly gotten into that box along with all sorts of items I had never seen before?" And then, just as quickly, I understood. The people who were framing me must have stolen it off the table by the front door, where I made it all too easy for them to find, then planted it with the other evidence, knowing it would likely seal my guilt. I couldn't very well claim I had never seen the stuff in the box when my phone was with it.
"And where did the deputies say they found this box?"
Fell asked.
"In a closet in the nursery."
"Good God."
"You're calling it the nursery. This is the room where the child slept?"
Fell asked, not wanting the judge to miss the point.
"Yes."
"Did the deputies bring out anything else?"
"Yes. After they found the drug paraphernalia, they discovered the drugs themselves. They showed me several bags of white powder that they said was cocaine."
"And where did they tell you they had found that?"
"Also in the nursery, though they had been taped inside the air duct."
Which told me why the air conditioning exchange cover had been removed. It also meant Alex spent a night sleeping a few feet from a half kilo of cocaine. Anderson then testified how she developed knowledge that Alex was cared for by Ida Ferncliffe, who was licensed with Shenandoah Valley Social Services as an at-home child care provider, and how she went to remove Alex from there.
"And could you describe the condition of Alex at that time?"
Fell asked. I braced myself.
"He was in excellent condition," Anderson said. "He appeared to be healthy in all ways, very alert. He had just been changed. He was clearly well cared for."
"Did you ask the child care provider for her observations about the child?"
"Yes. She told me that, in her opinion, the child's mother was very loving and was doing an excellent job caring for the boy. She was reluctant to surrender the child at first, because she didn't feel it was possible there had been any abuse."
I felt such a flood of gratitude toward Mrs. Ferncliffe, I nearly started to cry.
Then Fell asked, "And what did you do to convince her that this was the necessary course of action?"
"I told her about what the sheriff's office had found in Ms. Barrick's house."
"About the cocaine?"
"Yes." Which explained why Mrs. Ferncliffe had turned on me.
"What did you do next?"
"I took the child to our office in Verona, where we performed a more thorough examination."
"And what did you find?"
"The child appeared to be very healthy. There were no bruises or other signs of physical abuse. But given that there was cocaine found in the home, it's standard procedure for us to test the child for drugs."
"What kind of tests did you administer?"
"We performed a blood test, a hair follicle test, and a skin test."
I was actually relieved to hear this. Finally, there would be some hard science here, not just anonymous accusations and easily misled sheriff's deputies. The people doing this to me could plant drugs in my home, but there's no way they could pump drugs inside my baby. This would be a crucial first step toward proving my innocence. I leaned forward on the desk as the testimony continued.
"You've been trained in how to perform these tests?" Fell asked.
"Yes, ma'am. Multiple times."
"Have you gotten the results back yet?"
"Not for the blood test and the hair follicle test. Those take a little while. We only have results for the skin test."
"Then let's talk about the skin test. Can you please describe for the court how this test is done?"
"It's pretty simple. You run a swab over the child's skin, paying particular attention to the hands, because that's the most likely way a child will ingest drugs, if there are, in fact, drugs present in the home. You then seal the swab in a tube and sign your name on the seal, so there's no dispute later about someone else in the chain of custody tampering with it. Then you send the tube to a laboratory here in Stanton."
"Have you gotten the results back yet?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"The child's skin and hands tested positive for cocaine." Before I even knew what I was doing, I was on my feet. This was just too bizarre, and I couldn't take it sitting down for one second longer.
"No," I said. "No, that is not possible. She did the test wrong."
"Miss Barrick, that's enough,"
Judge Stone said, scowling at me.
"She either did the test wrong or she faked the results."
"Miss Barrick, you're going to contain yourself or I'll have you removed from the courtroom."
"But, Judge, you don't understand. There has to have been a mistake of some kind. There is no way Alex could possibly have..."
And then I stopped myself. A recent memory came to me. It was from the morning after I had been bailed out for the first time. I had gone into the nursery, marveling at its emptiness, thinking about Hemingway as I stared down into the crib. There, I had seen that fine white dust on the sheet cover. It hadn't been baby powder.
Chapter 28. The computer the Augusta County Sheriff's Office used to scan in fingerprints was a desktop model that was absolutely cutting edge. for 2003. A decade and a half later, it was cranky, interfaced poorly with every other piece of electronics brought within a dozen feet of it, and was so slow, Amy swore it was being powered by a hamster running on a wheel somewhere. The man whose unfortunate job it was to massage results out of this imperfect system was Deputy Justin Herzog, a powerfully built former kickboxing champion whose close-cropped hair looked like it came straight out of a police equipment catalog. Whatever aggressions he built up while battling the computer during his shift, he worked them out later on a heavy bag. His hideaway at work was a small room that was nearly overpowered by the smell of chemicals. With Amy looking on, he slowly scanned the prints into the computer and digitally cleaned them so there would be a better chance of finding a match. Eventually, he got annoyed with Amy's shoulder hovering and said, "How about I just call you when I'm done?" It was nearing noontime when that phone call came. Amy, who had been killing time in the detective's bullpen, stopped just short of running down the hall to rejoin him. "Okay, so what do you got?" she asked, not feeling any fatigue from having been up since 3.
"Not enough, I'm afraid," Herzog said. "The detectives came back with a lot of prints, and I haven't processed all of them, of course, but we're looking at prints from 2 individuals."
"The victim and the perpetrator," Amy said.
"I've referred to them as Person A and Person B. The set of prints the victim gave us is Person A, and of course hers are all over the place. With Person B, I'm mostly working off a few partials. It's not like he was nice enough to press his fingers down on our scanner or anything."
"I understand."
"I picked the best 2 and ran them through our system and got 3 likely matches."
Which wasn't unusual, though Amy didn't need to be told that.
"But as soon as I looked at them, sorry, no dice."
"Are you sure?"
"I can talk you through all the arches, whorls, and loops if you want, or you can take my word for it. They're not a hit for anything we got. Person B is not known to us."
"Okay," Amy said. "So what now?"
"That's up to you," Herzog said. "We can send them down to Roanoke if you want."
She didn't. The backlog for fingerprints at the state crime lab wasn't as long as it was for DNA, but it would still take months. "Can you check for me if you have someone named Warren Plotz in the system?"
"Yeah, sure. Spell it for me."
She did, then watched him manipulate the tired, grubby mouse, filling in the appropriate fields. He clicked search. The hamster went for a jog, and Amy waited.
"Sorry," Herzog said at last. "No Warren Plotz."
Amy crossed her arms and stared at the screen, taking in a deep whiff of chemically tinged air. She had been here before with Warren Plotz. Close, achingly close, but not close enough. It was possible that DNA result would come back from the state lab any day, making all this fingerprint stuff unnecessary. For that matter, the Sprite can might have Plotz's prints on it. She hadn't bothered checking, because the rapist had never before been duped into leaving prints. But in either case, that would involve waiting. What if begging the lab director for an expedited result only knocked 30 or 60 days off the 156-day backlog? In the past, she hadn't pressed the issue with Plotz. She had been patient, measured, careful. All the things she was not going to be anymore. She was thinking of Lily Pritchett, whom she hadn't been able to protect from this scourge. Of Daphne Hasper and the other victims. Even of Melanie Barrick, who deserved to have her attacker sent to prison whether she was a drug dealer or not. But Amy was also thinking of a woman she hoped she'd never have to meet. The woman who wouldn't become a victim if she acted decisively. "When does your shift end?" she asked Deputy Herzog.
"Not till 6.
"Good. Don't go far. I'm going to get you a match for Person B this afternoon." She marched out of the room and into the detective's bullpen, where she prevailed on one of the deputies to let her borrow a computer that had printer access. She went to Warren Plotz's Facebook page, selected one of the photos without the douchebag aviator glasses, and hit print. Then she stared at the screen for a moment. She knew a legally viable witness ID